This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, an assistant professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Ciao. What's up?
Ciao, Katie. Not too much. I'm excited to be here talking with you as always. Spring has sprung officially in Hanover, so we're turning a real corner over here. And I am feeling super jazzed because we have so many new exciting things on our calendar for all of our Golosi and for everyone who especially has joined us lately through our Patreon.
Yeah, it's amazing. We have a Patreon or Patreon, and you can go to patreon.com/golapod and support us. This is especially useful for anchor supporters as we're migrating our whole support infrastructure over to Patreon, also known as Patreon. And we will never end the debate on how that is pronounced, ever. It will be ongoing. But jokes aside, we are just so overwhelmed by the outpouring of support. We love Gola. We love our Golosi. And now we have a whole, like, two new tiers of Golosità that you can get in on. We've got Ghiotti and Ghiottoni. Is that it?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay. No, forse devo dare un'occhiata anche a questa pagina. So we would love to shout out our new Golosi, Elisa Green, Sis Parm, David Rubatelli, Allison Ruggiero, and Jan Kubrick. Although I should actually make a correction. Allison Ruggiero is not a Golosa. She's a Ghiotta. And she has become a prime supporter of Gola in the name of her restaurant with her partner Gino in Rochester, New York. It is called Fiorella. And like, shout out to Fiorella. Did I ever tell you that Rochester, New York is one of my favorite cities on the planet?
You have not. Or if you did, I must have suppressed it. But okay, explain to me why.
Well, first of all, Allison and Gino were there and they're super cool. They met my sister on like Fish Tour or maybe like in the dead, like on a dead tour somewhere in the world. And I've known them for a really, really long time. And they visited me in Italy and actually recommended my friend Fiorella in Naples as a guide for them. And now they have a daughter and a restaurant called Fiorella. And it's not a coincidence. Fiorella is really cool and inspirational. And she's like the kind of person that wants you to, like, you sort of want to name things after her. That's how cool she is. But aside from that, their restaurant Fiorella just does like incredible Italy inspired foods, really great pizzas. Gino's family is from Campania. I love going to Fiorella on book tour. In fact, Rochester was my first stop for Food of the Italian South because the whole Ruggiero clan turns out and they're like 40 awesome people that, you know, came to New York in the 1960s and 70s, still maintain their dialect and their cuisine, and they're just awesome. So thank you, Allison. Thank you, Fiorella. Thank you, Gino. And yeah, that's my... this is not a sponsored Rochester ad. This is simply an outpouring of affection for a city that doesn't always get the love that it deserves.
Fair enough, Katie. You know what? I can't wait to go. I haven't had the great pleasure of dining at Fiorella yet, but I have put it right to the top of my list when the world gets back moving and we can start bouncing around like we always do after all the best bites in the U.S. and beyond. In addition to our wonderful friend, Allison at Fiorella, we also have to shout out, as we always will, Leah at Semolina Artisanal Pasta in Pasadena, because she is also a Ghiotta and because she is also inspiring us every day with the amazing food that she puts out and the very hard work that she puts into giving the kind of quality Italian products to her clients that Katie and I really support and feel good about promoting. So shout out to all of our new patrons. We're so pumped to have you. We're so grateful. We are so excited to start sharing more new content with you and special events, because that's part of what being a patron gets you. And that's part of what we have been enjoying over the last few months. And Katie, in addition to our patrons, we got to shout out some of our amazing supporters who have just given us even more money while we've been doing our live events, because that is not only the most generous and lovely thing that they could do, but also a way that we know that they're there listening to us and hanging out when we do these live events. And that's what makes them so special.
Yeah. And I think we established this on the previous pod, but this money does not go directly to us per se. Although I do need some new shoes. That's a digression. This goes to improving our audio, our editing, funding our boot camps where we can record a lot of things together and purchase a lot of things to eat so that we can tell you about them and things to drink. You know, you get the idea. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much to Kelly Andriani, Julie Allen, Anthony Benedetti, Aaron Barnes, Cara Canella, Stephen Kihoki, Julianne Farraker, Katie Fisher, Sage Gallerano, Julie Goldman. Oh, ooh la la, you are generous. Thank you, Julie. Yeah, over to you, Danielle.
Julie is amazing. We do need a hard stop after Julie, because Julie, every time we do a live event, gives us an incredibly, incredibly generous donation and makes us feel like maybe we did something right. So extra props to Julie. Rolling ahead. Yeah, there are still more of you. This is amazing. I can't believe how long this list is. Ryan Grimes, Kimberly Clapture, Sabrina Lazarus, Paul Lewis, Matt McClutchy, Sandra Miguel, Jennifer Milberg, Cynthia Nash, Tracy Nualis, Susan Noonan, Carol Orton, who is also a patron but still gave us other money for this live event. Oh my God. Amy Ranum, Connie Reeve, Ashley Robinson, Mary Rogers, Dan Savilli, Roy Spezia, Samantha Viglienghi. We know that probably Samantha doesn't do the hardcore Italian pronunciation in real life, but we like to really lay it on in Gola, as you all know. And Todd Vladkia, we are so thankful, so, so happy to be working with all of you and doing all of these fun things together. Every time you send us money, like Katie said, it goes to defraying the cost of putting the podcast together and organizing and executing the events that we have on the docket. So look out for even more of them. The more you support us, the better the content gets. We can't wait to share it with you.
Yes, grazie, everyone. We appreciate you. And if another reminder, if you're on Anchor supporting us, we love that. But switch on over to patreon.com/golapod. And now that we've got the sort of accounting business out of the way, we're going to talk about yet another topic I'm passionate about. Passionate. And I know you are too.
I actually, yeah, this is one topic for us that I'm surprised we haven't gotten to sooner. We decided to talk corn on our last episode because Katie just loves an insalatona and can't get enough of niblets, I guess. But I have been working for a long time on this subject in my academic research, and it's something that Katie has written about at length in cookbooks she's worked on and in articles and also in all kinds of other practices. And it's literally the essence of the, you know, idea of Italian cuisine in a way. And it's, of course, frumento, which means, Katie?
Grains. Talking about grains today.
We're talking grains. And we're going to focus on wheat mostly because that's going to be the kind of driving factor. But we're going to open that up to include things like orzo and farro and other words or products that you've heard of and try to parse out some of that for everyone listening, because it does get a little bit confusing. And it also is historically important to understand when those kind of divisions happen and who relied on what when. So, Katie, we talked corn last week. We're moving over to grains and the kind of general area of wheat and beyond. What gets you going here? Why are you so passionate about this subject?
Well, I think like a lot of things, tomatoes come to mind. It's a concept that we can all wrap our heads around. We know what grains are in theory, but there are so many different types, species. The way that grains are grown and the places that they're grown can influence not just the final flavor, but also the protein quality, the ability of that grain to be fermented into a dough that has certain cooked characteristics. It's this never-ending world. And, you know, I started really getting into grains in beyond just being like an enthusiastic eater of them when I wrote Flour Lab, which is a book about using freshly milled flour to make pasta, pizza, pastries, and I always forget the last one. Pasta, pizza, pastries, and bread. the idea that like you can walk through your flour aisle, whether you're in Italy or France or Japan or the US, and just be like bombarded by a lot of words that don't actually tell you about what's going on a molecular level when you mix flour, which is milled grains, and water. So, you know, we're definitely going to get into flour and the kind of complex world of Italian flour, but that's not the only way you're going to encounter grains. Especially in Italy, you find whole wheat berries are used in soups and stews and salads. What are some other ways that grains are consumed? I feel like bread's the most obvious. Pasta, second most obvious. What else is going on?
Well, maybe we can take the long historical walk that I love to drag everyone on, and it'll jog our memories and give people some of the context that they're always looking for, or that I'm always shoving down their throats either way. I think that
beer. Sorry.
Oh my God. Yeah. Put a pin in that. We do need to make sure we get back to beer. No question. I know. Although I'm actually recording on the early side for me now with Katie on Rome time. I usually have to chime in the morning, although she stays up all night. So that's a sort of a moot point. But I normally don't get to have a drink while we're recording right now because I have other work to do during the day. But it's really good weather here, and I may crack a beer when we get to that point. Go wild. Why not? Who cares?
All right.
I do what I want. I'm a doctor. What are we talking about when we're talking about greens in an Italian context? We're talking about the food that becomes a point of reference in a much more profound way than any other, and in a much more profound way than just its nutritional value. So we can start with the Roman Empire or the Roman Republic, really, not just because we tend to trace that, you know, as we do on our podcast and as historians do generally, trace ourselves back to that point as a point of departure for Italian culture being sort of hegemonized in some way. But actually, when it comes to grain, it's even more rooted in that particular historical moment, because most people will tell you, if they've studied the Roman Republic into the empire politically, that this is where food becomes the most important thing in Italian culture and in terms of Italian governing structure, because Rome bases a great deal of its success on its ability to provision the empire with grain, and especially with wheat. And so much of the political success of that political cultural cultural project, and then vice versa, so much of the kind of cultural success of Rome that made it something that people wanted to be a part of, to become citizenry and to participate in that sense, was because of the guaranteed and persistent availability of grain. And so much then kind of blooms from there. So as you go moving ahead into the moment historically that I focus on, the high into late Middle Ages, you see as the, you know, following the fall of the empire, and we have the fractionalization of the political system across the continent, and then within Italy, the comuni or these little city states and things and other systems moving in, you have everyone looking to the presence of grain as a a sign that the government is in place, and the lack of green as a sign that things are going really badly. And there are all kinds of amazing art historical points of reference here we can go to. If you've ever been to Siena and you've seen the Ambrogio Lorenzetti frescoes, the models of good and bad government, there are, we've mentioned some in the Villa Farnese in Rome in our last episode. You're looking at people expressing their contentment and their faith in their government and in their community through food, and it's represented with grain. And so grain becomes this anchor, this hugely important anchor when it comes to living in Italy from the ancient Roman moment all the way up to and including right now. It's way more than the sum of its parts, and way more than just bread, pasta, and beer, et cetera, et cetera.
Definitely. So, you know, if we're going back to Roman antiquity, we need to be thinking about the types of grains that were consumed back then. Some that you can, you know, continue to source for your own food consumption today: millet, emmer, and spelt. And there were really large production zones for the cultivation of this grain in the southern part of Italy, as well as in North Africa. And there was a really vibrant commerce that was created as a result of the grain, sort of like the annual grain cycle, right? So then as now, grain can be sowed at different times of year, harvested at different times of year. Generally in Italy today, however, there's a real focus on the type of wheat that's harvested throughout the summertime. And this is, you know, likely derived from the fact that harvesting wheat in, or any other type of grain in a hot, dry climate can contribute to its longevity, because you don't just like harvest all the grains and then eat all the grains in one day. On the contrary, the reason they're such an important product is because they can be further dried and stored and then milled to be used upon demand. Or, you know, you can mill in advance, but flour deteriorates in its nutritional value and quality as soon as the milling process takes place. So that's why the sort of whole wheat berries were more valuable. And then these products would be distributed, you know, throughout the empire in a way, kind of like homogenizing culture for what would have been very disparate groups. I think it's also, you know, noteworthy, you know, to mention that there was grain in Italy for sure before the Romans were doing stuff, but the Romans were really, really good at co-opting the technology and the species, of course, the labor of other communities, and then mass producing it, right? Scaling it up in a way that the Western world had never seen. So a lot of the varieties of wheat that would have been growing in Italy and that would have been used for food as well as for beer production would have already been crops in Etruscan settlements, Oscan culture, Sicily-based Phoenician culture, Greek culture all over the south and in Sicily as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the shift away from that much greater diversity happens as a result of that scaling up. And I want to be careful here because there's still a lot more diversity in terms of the types of grains. And then even within wheat, for example, the types of wheat available at this time versus what we're getting today. And we'll get to monocultures in a minute. But the Roman, and particularly once we move into the imperial phase, they start focusing on wheat because wheat is lighter and is more easily transportable. So we see the emphasis on places like Sicily, the rest of the Italian south, and especially, actually much more importantly, Egypt, which falls under the aegis of the empire at that point, beginning to turn to mostly wheat production, because in order to provision such a vast and sprawling empire, they needed something that was going to pack a lot of nutritional punch and be easy to move while not deteriorating quickly, as Katie was pointing to, in terms of whole wheat before it has been processed. So we have all of these options on the peninsula. They pre-exist Rome. They continue to be produced all the way up to and including now. They make a lot of different things, but we have a kind of through line that starts with the Roman Empire up until today, that's a focus on wheat and especially white wheat as a product of excellence and something that's really interesting when it comes to working with it for breads and pastas and et cetera.
Yeah. And white wheat is, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about sort of white flour, grain that's been milled to pulverize the wheat berry and then has had the bran and germ sifted out, leaving the starchy white endosperm in its wake. If you've got a sort of idea of a wheat berry in mind, it's kind of crazy because for a long time, you know, like I guess in high school or whatever, I would like have wheat berry salad or whatever. And then I didn't realize that you just like could mill the same thing and make flour. It didn't occur to me, but it's shocking. But yeah, now I know.
If you haven't seen it, I mean, how would you know that? I would, anyone listening, if you don't know what a wheat berry looks like, Google it right now. There's an image comes up right away that's really useful. And where, I mean, I guess it changes a little bit based on where you're searching from, but you'll find one and you'll see that you recognize all the parts actually because of what Katie is saying, because we've seen them in other instances, but we don't necessarily kind of connect that all together from flour to berry.
Yeah. And you can sort of create the analogy of the egg. The wheat berry is composed of bran, which is like the outer shell of an egg, endosperm, which is the carbohydrate and mineral rich material that provides white flour when it's milled, and the germ, which is the mineral rich embryo that feeds a wheat seed if it germinates. And so like also think about bran and the eggshell analogy in the creation of dough. Because bran is sharp and it slices the protein network, the gluten network, which is itself composed of two main proteins, glutenin and gliadin. And we're kind of, you know, sinking into some technical territory here, and we're going to get into more of that. But I think I just took us off topic from the point you were trying to make.
No, not at all. That's great. And the main point was only to say that we see an emphasis on wheat, and then within that, the wheat milled in the way that you're describing, Katie, to make especially bread first and foremost. And that maybe was where I was trying to get in when we were discussing before, you know, what people are using grain for or why grain becomes important. The first thing is bread. It's not pasta. And people who have listened to our podcast are not going to be surprised by that. But ci tengo a sottolinearlo comunque. The emphasis on pasta is way later. It did not have the effect on what grains were being produced or how they were being produced and used that it has today for most of the history that we're looking at. So the emphasis was on the production of bread at often an individual level, more or less, and then using whatever else you had for the kind of maximum nutritional potential. So you might have gotten really nicely milled white flour from the wheat that was available, but then you would have also used other byproducts and other grains to supplement the grain in your diet beyond that.
And so when we're thinking about breads that people were eating historically from even pre-Roman antiquity to, let's say, like 1850-ish is when European and therefore Italian bread production sort of shifts away from small artisanal production exclusively to a growing larger scale commercial baking industry. What types of breads, like what do these breads look like?
Well, so a lot of them will look similar to the things that you could find in an Italian bakery now, in that there are forms that are kind of local or have regional identities and that are using what is easily found in certain areas. Most people will be familiar with the fact that bread from especially Puglia is famous. And so there are now bakeries in Florence where you can get a pane pugliese pretty easily. And there are other options like that. But even today, you'll still see forms that are regionally identifiable and that use things that people were making themselves before this transition to larger industrial scale making of bread and purchasing of bread. But the real big difference would have been that an individual is going to be getting a kind of bread that will be based strongly on income and then reflective of class as a result of that. And almost without exception across the peninsula and on a long history scale, that means that people of lower working classes, of less economic availability, would be getting breads that are not made with the kind of white flour from wheat that is both softer and more easily pliable when you're actually working with it in the kitchen as well, and instead would have had a mixed grain, multigrain bread, as we would call it now, that's much darker. Or even no white wheat at all, and so then a much rougher grain kind of bread. And those would have been created normally in relatively to our standards now, large loaves that were then held on to for the duration of a week or more, because, again, we're talking about the manual labor of moving from sometimes even milling your own flour, but probably getting it from your a kind of immediate miller within your community, from flour to baked bread each time you have to do it. So nobody is getting 3 times a day to make bread. They are putting it together and often sort of also doing it as a kind of teamwork, where you would even, for example, have your bread fired at the forno closest to you and not necessarily in your own house, so you didn't have to maintain a fire every day, all the time.
Right. And it's kind of relatively recent in Italian grain history that master bakers like Gabriele Bonci or Franco Palermo are selecting specific grains, maybe even sifting whole wheat flour to the desired bran inclusion that they're wanting to use, and then making breads that have this big, wide open crumb. Natural fermentation would have been the standard, you know, before the advent of various types of dry yeast and the sort of lab yeast that we're so familiar with. But pre-1850s, and certainly into other parts of Italy pre-1950s, there would have been really discernible vocations associated with bread production. There would be the farmer that harvests the grain, the miller that mills the grain, the individual that produces the bread using flour, and the baker, the person who was in charge of the fire and baking the loaves. And so there really was this much larger sort of ecosystem around bread production.
Yeah, absolutely. And that change, as you mentioned, Katie, you know, we pointed to the mid 19th century as a moment where bread becomes kind of more an industrial product in the sense of being mass produced and being available at a shop as opposed to made at home at first. But you then make the very important point that it's not until the mid 20th century that we see the kind of ecosystem around bread start to break down, because people are mostly doing their shopping for foods that are a little bit further along in the kind of chain of production than before. So still using raw ingredients in the home, but not expecting to have a freshly baked loaf of bread available every day at the private kitchen level.
Definitely. And, you know, it's kind of shocking if you think that the way that we consume grain-based products today is so new. For 10,000 years, perhaps even more, there was this hyper-local cultivation, milling, transformation, and consumption of grain products. And then in the mid-19th century, perhaps a bit earlier even, in Eastern Europe, the advent of the roller mill allows the stone mill to be kind of like slowly shelved. And the roller mill just like pulverizes the grains, mashes the grains, and makes it much easier to sift out the bran and germ, both of which have great nutritional value, but also have these essential oils which render the grain flour rancid if not kept properly, or at least prevent the flour from being shelf stable. So white flour also has this potential not just to last a lot longer than whole wheat or different types of grain flours with bran in them, but also to be transported all over the world, literally. And so, you know, when you're shopping in your supermarket today, in let's say you're in Rochester, New York, we'll do a little shout out, or Pasadena, California, a Semolina artisan pasta shout out. You're going to be confronted with flours that might be coming from the US. So flour that's made from grains cultivated and milled in the US, or you might be looking at some Italian flour that's made from Italian grain milled in Italy and then shipped over, or, which is actually very common, Italian companies selling flour that is made from Canadian or American grains that have been shipped over for milling and then milled and then sent back to North America. It's a crazy thing. That would not be possible if the roller mill didn't allow a shelf-stable product to be efficiently and cheaply produced. And so I know it's always sort of like romantic to think that like our grandparents were eating all of this really homemade artisanal bread, but no, like industrial commercial bread baking and other grain production has been the norm for almost 200 years now.
Yeah. And that's, I think, a great way to transition into talking about the thing that I'm sure a lot of people are expecting us to get to, which is what people are eating now and how far we are from so-called heritage grains, which is a big part of our kind of contemporary foodways conversation. So, you know, we talked about the diversity of grains available on the peninsula from Roman times and that have continued to be produced and used to supplement and also for specific taste reasons as well, for the desire to enjoy those grains and to use them for dishes that are adapted to them. But then we know, and I think we can kind of fast forward quickly through this part that because we've talked about monocultures in a variety of different contexts. And if people are interested in this idea, they should go back to the corn episode that we just recorded right before this. And then also to our hazelnuts and Nutella podcast, which speaks a lot about this. But we are now in a situation where most people, as Katie, you're alluding to, are not more than even having one particular kind of wheat flour or one particular kind of product behind the whatever bread or pasta they're eating, are just totally unaware of what the product is at all, right? Of what the kind of raw ingredient is, because there's this idea that it's just flour and it mixes with stuff and makes other stuff. And we kind of know, we see wheat fields and think like, oh, okay, that's where that comes from. But there's not this connection with the process as a whole. And there's not really a great deal of awareness about what the difference is among those possibilities either, I think anyway.
No, I mean, I agree. It wasn't until I started visiting mills in the US and in Italy that you really get a sense of the microscopic scale at which heritage grains, ancient grains are being cultivated and milled, generally through collaborations between very small farms and very small mills to produce flour for a specific audience. The professional baker or pasta maker, or the very skilled home baker or pasta maker. And, you know, when we're thinking about pasta and bread, these two major sources in which grains are consumed, it's the characteristics of those final products that are really heavily influenced by the type of grain that's being used. I'll use the example of durum wheat. Durum wheat, which generally is like, I guess, translates to hard wheat, grano duro, it is literally just a harder wheat berry than that of soft wheat. It has very high protein potential, right? So when you look at often the specs for flour, you'll be given the percentage of protein per 100 grams. So let's say a durum flour has 14% protein. It's pretty high protein, right? And too much protein to make a tender product. So you wouldn't want to use that to make pastry. You would want something with much lower protein, a soft wheat with 11% protein, for example. So basically, as Americans, we're sort of trained to think about flours based on their protein content. So, you know, if you're a pastry maker, you know that you want like a tender product with lower protein and like the 10 to 11% protein range. If you're making, you know, bread with a big wide open crumb, you're programmed to want 13 to 14% protein content. But that's a really vague term, and it's not even really specific enough, because there are two important proteins that are in within the endosperm of wheat flour, the gliadin and the glutenin. And when hydrated, when you mix them with flour, they combine to form a gluten network, which is that protein network that traps gases as the dough rises, because the yeast, whether it's you're adding active dry yeast or sourdough starter, is kind of digesting the simple sugars in the flour and like kind of belching out carbon dioxide and alcohols like esters that create aromas and stuff. So the relative quantities of gliadin and glutenin are going to, along with the hydration of the dough, I should say, and where the dough is in its life cycle, are going to influence whether your dough is elastic or extensible. And glutenin is promotes elasticity, whereas gliadin favors extensibility. I hope you guys are still with me on this discussion, because it took 15 years to freaking figure out what any of this means. Elasticity means that the dough will spring back to its original shape when you stretch it, like a rubber band. So it implies the dough's capacity to be stretched without tearing. Oh, sorry, no. Extensibility is the capacity of the dough to be stretched without tearing or snapping back. And so what does this mean? Like, a good balance of elasticity and extensibility will allow you to create a dough that rises and holds its shape and doesn't sort of like flatten out, or doesn't just remain really flat in the first place. You brought up the important example of bread in Puglia. Pane Pugliese is often made with durum wheat, which does not have the protein capacity to stretch really, really into big open holes. If you are a member of the application Instagram, I'm sure you've seen the so-called autopsy shots of bread loaves, where bakers will slice their dough in half and you'll see all the big holes, and everyone's like really into the freaking big crumb holes and the open crumb. You got to get the open crumb. Well, you can't really do that if you're using like 100% durum wheat. You're going to have maybe a very flavorful dough if you're using great durum wheat, but it's going to remain a compact inner structure and not those big like tartine style open holes. So, you know, like, I urge people, as they're sort of encountering different grains and different flours, do look at the protein, but then also like, you got to figure out what that flour is going to do when you mix it with water and make it into pasta or make it into bread. Durum wheat is also really, I think, good example when it comes to pasta production, because we use durum wheat to make short little stubby shapes like cavatelli and orecchiette. And we use a soft wheat especially up in Emilia Romagna, to make those like almost stretchy, elastic, sfoglia-based pastas. And so it's the things that are happening on a microscopic level in the protein realm that are influencing what you can produce with those types of grain flours.
Yeah, that's a really great summary of a really complicated topic, Katie. And I think what your last examples helped to bring us back around to is the kind of broader cultural context here, which is, people using different kinds of grains broadly, and then within that, different kinds of different subtypes of those grains, and then even within that, different qualities of those subtypes according to the thing that they're going to make. And even now in Italian context, even as things have been thoroughly industrialized and most people actually don't care to know or inform themselves in a particular way about all the differences in the flours that come from these grains or the products that are made from them, there is a sort of cultural, historical hangover that remains, and that allows people to be inherently aware of the fact that you use some kinds of grains and the flours of those grains and certain types of flours within that to make certain things, because they work for that reason. And there is a long, because of the, you know, specificity and diversity of products at a regional level that come with that long history, there's still a frequent use and a kind of familiarity with all of these different products as they are sort of consumed within this richer context, even if people aren't themselves thinking, oh, well, this has X protein content in why ways, and that is why it's doing its job here. You know, the person who's rolling out the sfoglia might not say to themselves, "This is these are the specs on this flower, and that's why it's working." They say, "This is the kind of flour that works when I'm making this kind of pasta."
Exactly. And that's how it's marketed in Italy in particular. When you go to purchase flour, and most people are purchasing flour at supermarkets and not at bakeries or directly from mills, that type of commerce is, you know, comparatively non-existent. They are confronted with like very simple instructions in a way. You got your grano tenero 00, and then it says pasta on the bottom. Or you have your Farina d'America brand Manitoba flour, which is my favorite. It's got like an American flag on it, even though it's like supposed to be Canadian wheat. It's very confusing. That's for like strong breads. And, you know, because in Italy, when we're using flours, we're generally making bread or pizza or focaccia or pasta. The packaging tells us what we're supposed to do with that particular bag of flour. And there's not a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of variety of what you can find in supermarkets. And so it's important to know that there is this whole other world of grains out there that has been especially present in Piedmont and in Sicily, where there's been an increased interest in heirloom varieties that were essentially ignored because they didn't provide the yield that was necessary for industrial and conventional baking for a very long time. But now there is a market for it because there is a kind of interesting collision of interests in the Italian food and beverage world. About 15 years ago, there started to be a deep interest in beer brewing, and there started to be like celebrity bakers, and there started to be celebrity pasta makers. So I'm thinking of people like the Balladine Brewing Company, and Gabriele Bonci, and like Rina Poletti, where you have this new, like, almost, you're giving a face to what previously were kind of anonymous roles in the food production industry. And so it's cool to like make bread. And once you think you're cool enough because you're making this bread, you want to make more types of bread because making bread becomes an addiction. Or it makes you never want to bake bread again. So either you're like, you want to do it all the time. So you're constantly like, okay, well, I've tried all the flour in my supermarket. Why don't I go to the, you know, the bakery that that has, you know, some flour. Maybe I can ask for flour from them. Maybe I can get sourdough starter from them. Maybe I can learn something at this class. There is, you know, in the past decade and a half, a small, very small, but growing interest in the provenance of grains and the revitalization of small scale grain production that was really not considered commercially viable for, you know, let's say from 1850 until 2000, 2005.
You know, it's funny, what I am literally aware of that, but it's actually really nice to make this connection right now, because while we're walking through it, you know, as I said at the top, I spend a lot of time thinking about grain history and grain economics and how it has influenced people, especially at a political level, over a long history in Italy. And the little craft beer revolution, which actually we must dedicate a full podcast to, and we will shortly. Hopefully we're going to be in the same place and able to do some proper tastings so that we get that done right.
Should I get a kegerator?
Well, let's see how many patrons we get this week.
Would you guys approve of me using the Patreon money for that? No, I'm just joking. That'll be a personal business expense.
Don't worry. Our accountant won't let us do that.
I'm just imagining our future craft beer episode in front of a yet-to-be-built pub-style bar in my apartment.
I cannot wait. I actually, the one bad thing about our new platform, Squadcast, that we've been using now to facilitate this hopefully cleaner audio for you, is that it lets us see each other in real time. And so I'm always looking at Katie, who's basically sunbathing on her beautiful terrazza in Rome covered with plants and other magical Italian things, while I am wrapped in a blanket despite the ultimately fair weather here in Hanover and not in a particularly picturesque background. But to your point, Katie, we will come back to beer when we are together and have the proper setup for it. And everyone can look forward to that. But in the meantime, we can, you know, kind of wrap up our conversation about grain and how it has been the driving force behind so many things beyond itself and so many things even beyond the kind of food and food ways that we're talking about. As with the example that you said, I mean, it's not a coincidence that there's been a craft beer boom in Italy. It's not a coincidence that people are making weird little breads all the time. They work together, right?
Wait, wrapping up, are you done talking about this with me?
I think we have actually, on our last couple of, we keep stretching the amount of time we talk. Our listeners claim that they like that, but I kind of feel like it's when my students tell me that they really like when I go way over class time because I don't even notice that we've been meant to wrap up for something like 20 minutes ago. I'm just so excited about telling them about Dante. I can't even
shut myself up. Before you go anywhere, I mean, you can hang up if you need to go and I'll just keep talking about this. Although I think you're in charge of the Squadcast connection, so that might not work out. But, you know, I do want to talk a little bit about, we've been focusing on wheat, obviously, but we didn't discuss this like very confusing world of Italian flour, because if you're familiar with like German flour nomenclature or French or American, North American nomenclature, you kind of have to learn three different languages. Add Italian in and you got another wheat language to learn because we've got a series of numbers that are related to the milling fineness that is applied. So 00 is the most famous like Italian flour, right? People think, oh, 00 is a famous flour. No, it's a milling fineness. And any given mill might have a 00 flour that is engineered to work best with pasta sfoglia. So it might be soft wheat milled to that fineness. Another might be one that's sort of engineered to work well with breads and pizzas. So it might have a little bit of bran and germ inclusion, or maybe not much, but a mixture of durum and soft wheat, probably with the dominance of soft wheat. And then you've got your zero, which is less fine, your one and your two, which is the most coarse. And then, you know, add to that that you've got your semola rimacinata, which is basically semolina flour, your durum wheat flour, that's finer than that. So it's like milled again. So when you're baking Italian things, like just know that you can't switch one type of flour for the other. You got to think about hydration and all the things and like the fineness and the type of flour. And there's plenty more on this coming to a bookstore near you in October when the joy. So, oh shit, I almost said the name of the book and it's not public yet. Oh no. When hashtag untitled pizza book comes out and Dan and I discuss the intricacies of flour and really how to navigate that world. In the meantime, you can find Flour Lab, which is a book about using freshly milled flour for four types of foods. The litany of which I never am able to like nail completely, even though it's simple and it's on the cover. And if you just want to kind of like dip your toes into the Italian baking world, there is a great durum wheat and bread flour based focaccia on my website. If you just Google Katie Parla and focaccia pugliese or focaccia, it'll come up. And I think I'm going to publish my pizza recipe too, because I got an uni recently. And I really like it. And I'm actually mixing dough right now because I'm going to make a bunch of pizzas for myself later. And actually much later because it's like a 20-hour ferment. So like around 4 a.m. And yeah, and it's like, it's fun to kind of navigate things. And I encourage you, even though, you know, the made in Italy flour, it sounds very appealing. Look and see if you can find some cool grains available near you, mix different things and get really excited about that. And if you do want to sort of focus on things that Italians are enthusiastic about, at least the small but growing number of people who are really thinking about grains, look for einkorn, which is commercially available as enkir, corison wheat, which is called kamut, and then all types of like farro, farro piccolo, farro, cos'è? Farro piccolo, farro grande, vero? Sì. You know, different types of, no, it's actually farro grande, farro piccolo, farro medio. But farro grande is spelt, I think. Okay, I should know this. Anyway, don't quiz me on all of those details at this moment, but feel free to reach out with any questions that you've got, because we want to make your life even more grain-filled than it already is right now.
We sure do, Katie. I don't think we've found a topic that we're both this into in terms of the depth and breadth of our knowledge, because you really are possibly more detail-oriented about grain than I am, and that's really saying something.
I told you I'm passionate.
Well, speaking of being passionate, our fans continue to be. We love them so much. We want to thank you all again and thank you for listening to us, and remind you to hit the Patreon site, patreon.com/golapod. You become a patron, you'll start hearing from us more often and learning about all the exciting stuff we have on deck. And there is a lot, I swear, I promise, it's going to be great. And Katie, in the meantime, where can they find out what you're up to?
You can always find me at Katie Parla on all social media. I would urge you, if you want to get involved in a never-ending group chat, join my Italian Eating Club on Demi. It's literally a WhatsApp group. You can text me anytime and ask me stuff. But that's like not even the cool part about it. That's the least cool part about it. The cool part about it is that they're like 100 other people that are interested in Italy, and they're like so stoked to share recipes and like take snaps of their pizzas and share like their favorite ingredients. And it's just a really fun way to interact about Italy. And we talk about travel and language. And sometimes we have like a movie week. Every week there's a different theme. And this week's theme is pizza, which is my favorite food. Okay, I'm gonna keep the singing to a minimum, but as I mentioned, I got an uni, and this is not an ad, although it would be cool if they, you know, became,
yeah, so you can also reach out. Yeah.
I'm so obsessed with this thing. It is a beautiful gas oven that is on my terrace. I gaze out over the sunset while I bake pizzas. It is the most fun. And this week we're doing a live Zoom as part of the Italian Eating Club group. So it'll actually probably, this pod will drop after the fact. But what is important is that you can join me on this like Italian Eating Club journey. And every month we got a Zoom. Every week we've got a theme, and it's a lot of fun. That was a really long pitch. Demi community.
Excellent. I hope everybody jumps on. It's definitely an amazing idea, and I can see how much love everyone is giving to each other, as you have shown me. So in the meantime, they can keep up with both of us on our Instagrams. You're at Katie Parla and I'm at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet. They can chat with you via Demi. They can look out for more exciting Gola events on the horizon. And they can hopefully go play with some flour and water and maybe learn something while they're listening to us the second time through, because this podcast had so much information in it, they're probably drowning.
A lot of stuff. It's a lot of stuff, a lot of words. It's fun though.
It sure is. I can't wait to talk with you again very soon, Katie. Arrivederci to everyone, and a prestissimo.
Ciao, ragazzi.